You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
Now, they're saying I should think stuff like this. They're saying
something is wrong with me.
How'd you get to be so cynical?
Practice.
I am joined this week by, let me pull this up so I get it correct, because you sent me your information on how I should credit you. You are the Associate Professor of Communication at Quincy University, and you are also an You're an Emmy-winning television producer. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. All right. That is correct. And Thank you.
And I know you as former co-worker, friend, and former Positive Cynicism guest, Travis Yates.
Yes, I'm happy to be a repeat performer on the show.
Yeah, you're going to be, I think you're going to be like my Dr. Phil. Anytime we're dealing with sociological issues, I'm going to have you on the show.
Excellent. I'll start working on my Dr. Phil impersonation.
All right, yes. First one. Pretend that you are an actual doctor and
right. And just call me doctor.
I'm dealing with a little bit of audio issue. Hopefully it won't be too bad. Anyway, we are here because you and I had a little Twitter back and forth over the weekend about kind of the state of our society. And, you know, with everything that's going on in politics right now, you had made the comment that your six-year-old son acts more mature than politicians.
It certainly seems that way these days, yes.
Sadly, this is the case. I think that kind of hit me at the point because the day prior I had seen this new trailer for a new documentary about Mr. Rogers. And it just got me thinking about my childhood. And, you know, I know from probably like the ages of 4 through 9 or 10, I was watching Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers, The Electric Company, like all these PBS children's programming that tried to instill good value into kids. And not having kids myself, so I'm hoping you can shed some light on this, is, well, first off, did you grow up watching these shows as well?
I did, absolutely. Like, you know, like most of the middle-aged adults. I think that we all grew up on these shows. I think that they were staples of our childhood, and they certainly played a role in shaping our view of the world when we were very young.
You know, I know Sesame Street is still on the air, but I don't know if it's still on PBS. I know HBO bought the rights to it a few years ago. Mr. Rogers sadly passed away in 2003. Electric Company, I don't think is still on. So I don't know. I think Arthur might be a PBS show, but I don't know what else is out there for kids. What is your son watching right now?
Well, so he's almost 7, so he's kind of moved past you know, the Mr. Rogers phase of his life, and he's moved on to some more complex shows. And he's myself being a child of the 80s, he's very much into the 80s popular culture that I've exposed him to. So Back to the Future, Ghostbusters, he really loves all of these things. So he has kind of moved on. But when he was younger, I certainly looked for the type of programming that I grew up on, that you just, you know, listed. And we had Sesame Street. There were repeats of Mr. Rogers. You know, now we have Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, which is in the same spirit, but in an animated form. There are some shows out there that that do still try to echo the sentiments of a Mr. Rogers Neighborhood. One specifically, a animated show on Nick Jr. called Bubble Guppies, and you know, it's not this chaos style of production that we're seeing so much now in television. It's still more basic, and they've got some musical numbers to help teach values and things like that. But on the flip side, for every program like that, there are these cartoons that lack the values that these, you know, the Sesame Streets and the Mr. Rogers had. And you know, the narratives are more complex for young kids, and it's a, I think it's a little much for them to take in when they're first getting exposed to television. So that's a bit of a concern.
And that makes me think too, like with our childhood, as we, you said, we're both children of the 80s. So after we had moved on from the PBS fair, we had, you know, cartoons like G.I. Joe, He-Man, Transformers that were essentially 30-minute commercials trying to sell toys. And there was a lot of violence, although it was very cartoony. You know, G.I. Joe was the most elite fighting force who had aim like a stormtrooper. They could never actually hit anybody. But then at the end of the show, you always got that 30-second wrap-up of a good moral. Like, you know, they always try to teach a lesson.
Yeah, and if you think of the, you know, it was very cartoony, as you say. And then if you think back, after the exposure to that cartoony violence, there, you know, what other violence were we exposed to, at least on television? Not much, as opposed to today, where we're just inundated with it. So, yeah, it was. There was some violence in the cartoons that we grew up with, but you know, it was very cartoonish, very childlike, and then certainly limited compared to what we're looking at today.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I'm going to speak off reference, I guess, because I haven't done the research on this, but you know, the television the primetime programming during our youth, you know, we had A-Team and MacGyver and stuff that was violent, but I don't know if it was as violent as what we see today. And I know after the Newton school shooting a few years ago, I went through and looked at just the four main networks, and I think it was like 85% of all primetime programming focused on crime and violence. And yeah, I wonder, like, what effect does that have on our society?
So let me go kind of way back and build back to that point of the violence in society and why that's existing, or the violence in television. So research shows that mass media ranks right below family and church as influencing our behaviors. So, you know, the research is there that we are affected by what we see on television. And the golden age of network television, the 1950s to really about the early 80s, when we had the big three networks, these programs served as social instruction for most of America. So it set our social norms, and it often did it through comedy and the sitcom. So comedy as social discourse is a very powerful tool for us to discuss controversial subjects. You know, it puts a sheen on topics and lets us talk about them that when we might not otherwise do so. So you look at a program like All in the Family in the 70s. I mean, it was groundbreaking in that it got us laughing, but it got us talking about things like racism, misogyny, and xenophobia. And mass media it's a mirror. It's a cultural mirror that reflects what's happening in our society. So the 60s counterculture paved the way for All in the Family. Second wave feminism gave way to the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Good Times initially tackled African-Americans struggling in the inner city before unfortunately shifting to the comedic exploits of J.J., falling back on some traditional stereotypes. But these shows allowed audiences to kind of dip their toes in the water of some progressive stances and let us slowly warm up to them. So my theory on kind of what played a big role in the rise of Donald Trump is the fall of network television, because it was the decline of this instruction that served as a social playbook for us, right or wrong, and I'll get to that in a second. But I think perhaps not coincidentally, also a huge explosion in these progressive movements that kind of has proved to be a little too much for the American public, specifically in some deeply red areas of the country. And it's led us to voting for someone that's playing into the fears of these huge changes that occurred specifically during the Obama terms. And I think the violence then on television that you noted is doing the same thing. It's playing on our fears. We just had the March for Our Lives, which is addressing the gun culture. well, why do we have such a gun culture? Well, you know, there's two schools of thought, but one is we have to protect ourselves. Well, why do we, what are we so scared of? Well, we, all we see is violence on television, and we're convinced that the world is this really scary place, and unless we have an armory in our house, we're not safe. So, you know, I think that what we're seeing on television is very much playing a role in the debates that we're having today and all of the main issues that we're seeing today. I'm not saying that the social instruction that we've received through the years on television is right. For example, you take a look at the bumbling fathers in sitcoms from, you know, the last 20 years, and then you look around at, you know, dads that can't seem to figure out how to change a diaper. You know, that's a case of the social instruction doing some damage, giving today's dads an out for, you know, not being involved in the child rearing process. So I'm not advocating for what messages are coded in the TV programs. I'm just pointing out that what it did was keep us on the same page on a lot of issues. And now we're not on the same page, and we don't know how to deal with that. We've got to learn how to work our way through these issues that we don't agree with without that social instruction being provided by us from the networks anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you just said a lot that I want to try to go through and unpack if I can remember everything. But I want to start off first by tying back into Mr. Rogers, because you and I both watched a documentary that's available on Amazon called Mr. Rogers and Me. And it's about a guy who lived next door to Mr. Rogers, who's literally Mr. Rogers' neighbor. And they talked about how Mr. Rogers got first started out in television because he had seen some other program where people were throwing pies at each other, which is a comedy staple dating back probably to the 20s and 30s. But to Mr. Rogers, that was very demeaning. And the last thing he wanted to watch was people demean other people. But then we turn on television today, and that seems like all that there is. It's very demeaning. And so I don't know where this line of viewership has been to where, why do we enjoy watching the negative aspect? And one of my thoughts is, you know, you look at the reality television genre, which, you know, after I worked in it for 10 years, I had to get out because it was just it was very soul crushing to be like, I am not benefiting society in any way. That's my own moral soapbox. But, you know, I look at shows like, you know, Honey Boo Boo, Jersey Shore, and even Duck Dynasty when it first started. I think television producers are trying to find people that we regular folks can watch and kind of feel superior to and say like, wow, at least I'm not that crazy or I'm not that bad. Do you have any thoughts on that aspect?
Yeah, so that was kind of this, one of the staples of the sitcom formula as well, is that we always felt just a little bit better than the characters in the show. We would leave with kind of feeling a little bit better about ourselves because, boy, we're not in the crazy situations. We haven't found ourselves in the trouble that the people we just watched on TV did. And what they've done with reality TV is taken that formula and put it on steroids, essentially. And it does exploit the worst, I think, oftentimes, of human emotion and humankind. And, you know, not only are we often, you know, walk away feeling better about ourselves, but we feel sometimes, you know, disgusted at what we've seen. Why we keep tuning back in, I'm not sure. I do know that it seems like target demographics, especially for reality TV, has started to skew younger and really targeted that kind of 18 to 25 range, whereas it didn't used to be like that because 18 to 25-year-olds didn't have the money to spend. And so advertisers wouldn't go after that the programs that targeted that demographic. You know, I haven't seen the research, but I'm you know, there might be now some, you know, excessive disposable incomes that these 18 to 25-year-olds have now. I mean, they certainly play a role in shaping popular culture and you know, setting trends. And so maybe that's the end game for advertisers. But I agree with you wholeheartedly that that the direction that reality TV has gone is extremely negative. And you know, and it's a formula. It's cheap to produce. You're not dealing with trained actors. It can be sometimes thrown together quickly. And so, you know, for TV producers looking for content, it's a great formula. Unfortunately for us, for audiences and for society that you know, takes these messages to heart, it's very damaging.
Yeah, that's true, because I believe it was, you know, Hollywood had a writer strike back in 2008, which by the laws set forth in the Writers Guild, reality shows technically do not have writers. So that was the only programming that could still be produced while on strike. And like you said, it's cheap, it's easy, and just about anything could be made into a reality show. But then looking at, you know, going back, looking at the types of shows that are on television now, as we've said, you have the reality, which is like lowest common denominator, you know, glorifying bad behavior. You have, you know, your Law and Order, CSIs, all this violence. And then you have your sitcoms, which, as you've mentioned, you know, have portrayed men as bumbling idiots for the last 15, 20 years. But I also notice in sitcoms, and I don't know if this is just me getting older and more prudish, but they seem to be seem to be gearing more towards a bottom of the barrel, you know, a lot more vulgarity, more sexual innuendo. Like, not even, it's not even innuendo now. It's just plain out. You know, I remember Two Broke Girls, which I could never watch more than like 2 minutes of, where there's one joke at the beginning. Well, it was supposed to be a joke, where Kat Dennings, this character, is talking to the other one, and she's like, "Oh, what did he do for you?" And she's like, "I don't know. He got me, I don't even remember the exact scene, but she was talking about how great her boyfriend was." And she's like, "Oh," and Kat Dennings is like, "Oh, well, you should totally do anal." And I'm like, that's not even a joke. Like, that's just, it's so blatant now. And I don't know if that's, you know, one of the ideas that I've been struggling with is, does television shape society, or does society shape television?
And as I alluded to, yeah, it's both. But I think that the power that television has is much greater than I think people give it credit for, as I illustrated with just a few programs. And so, yeah, we've lost the shared experience, and there's so much content out there now. And you know, from a production standpoint, I would argue that television has gotten better. Mm-hmm. You know, especially now that, you know, it's getting harder and harder to even define television as a whole, because you look at some of the Amazon Prime originals, you look at Netflix originals, Hulu originals. They're done in TV format, but we're not consuming them through the traditional delivery methods. So even defining what TV is now is a moving target. And then you look at all the different kinds of content that's out there, and then you see how liberal a lot of it has become, and in these primetime slots as well, where, you know, children are still potentially watching. And then, you know, you have the references like you alluded to from Two Broke Girls, which is highly inappropriate. But, you know, we're in an age right now where I can't watch the news with my son because if they're covering the president, because of, you know, all of the language and the things being discussed related to Stormy Daniels and things of that nature. So, it's certainly, the landscape has not only changed, but seismically shifted, I would argue.
Well, and then my next question is this going to be a continuation? And I was having a discussion with a friend over the weekend, talking about this podcast and the idea. And she was like, you know, she brought up, like, is society really that much worse than it was before? Or are we getting older? And, you know, it's always like, you look at music and the generation before the current generation will always say, oh, our music was better, your music is just getting worse. Are we, as I alluded to earlier, are we just getting older and more sensitive, or is society kind of going downhill? And if so, can it be brought back? Is there any way to kind of redeem ourselves? And I don't want to say go back to like the Leave It to Beaver 1950s mentality, but get back to where we focus on the positives of society instead of the negatives.
So there's a really good debate that's happened that I discussed with my communication students. So in the book, Everything Bad is Good for You, author Steven Johnson makes the argument that popular culture is making us smarter. And the essence of his argument is that the narratives of our television programs, films, and music have become more complex, and they demand more of us cognitively. The flip side to that, author Neil Postman argues that our growing dependence on entertainment has us essentially amusing ourselves to death, which is the title of one of his books, and that advertisers figured out long ago that the quality and usefulness of products are subordinate to the artifice of their display. So essentially saying that the packaging is more important than the product. It's style over substance. So, you know, there's merit to both arguments, but we as an audience have to select these complex narratives to exercise our brains as we watch them, but we're not doing that. If you look at the ratings of shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians, all the Real Housewives, these reality shows that you mentioned earlier that are promoting all this chaos and vitriol, it pokes holes in Steven Johnson's theory that pop culture is making us smarter when this low culture, and like you said, the lowest common denominator, is the dominant culture. And it opens the door for Postman's argument that, you know, this flashy, trendy programming that's void of substance is getting all our attention. So here's where I'm going to get real philosophical here. So Postman also, in the book Amusing Ourselves to Death, he presents a contrast of two dystopias. One is from George Orwell's book, 1984, and one is from Aldous Huxley's book, Brave New World. So Orwell's dystopian vision was predicated on an outside oppressive force, where Huxley's vision was a society collapsing under the oppression of technologies that basically undo our abilities to think for ourselves, and that truth becomes irrelevant in the face of all these distractions. So I think it's scary and clear that Postman was right in suggesting that Huxley's vision would come to fruition, and I think that the very frightening thing is that we're watching that vision of a dystopia unfold in real time. These distractions, that technology is now playing such a dominant role in our lives, it scares the hell out of me. I mean, I'll be honest, especially as a father. I'm having trouble processing what's happening right now, and I struggle to think how hard it's going to be for my son as he grows up and also tries to figure all this out. You know, when I, as an educated, middle-aged man, am having trouble figuring it out. So, yeah, I mean, you asked the big million-dollar question, Chad, of, you know, is society getting worse and can we come back from it? You know, I would argue, without trying to sound like the angry young man shaking my fist, you know, get off my lawn, that we've started down a rabbit hole of technology and distractions, and we're all so busy, you know, as it's brought up in the Mr. Rogers documentary that you referenced, where we're not taking the time to essentially stop and smell the roses, to stop and enjoy nature, and stop and appreciate the relationships in our lives, because we're just so surrounded by distractions. And, you know, once that floodgate opens, once that technological floodgate is open, it's almost impossible to shut. I don't see it shutting anytime soon. So, you know, that's what we're looking at.
Yeah, well, you know, right now there's a whole debate going on with Facebook where this Cambridge, whatever they're called, was selling information, which has been going on pretty much since the beginning of Facebook, so I don't know why it's such a big issue now, but, you know, people are threatening to shut down their Facebook accounts, and granted, even if Facebook were to go away, there will be another similar program to pop up to take its place, but maybe this is a good cause. Maybe this is a chance for people to kind of monitor how much they're using social media. Like, I think social media is a great tool because it obviously is a way to keep in touch with people outside of your neighborhood. But the over-reliance, I think, on social media to, and you probably know more, you've probably done more research on this, like the narcissism of today's generation where, you know, like everything has to be a selfie, everything has to, we have to identify everything that we do to share with people. And I know I was guilty of that myself a few years, and it took like some, like actually being called out on some actions to be like, you know what, I don't need to post every event of my life on social media because, you know, the people that would care are probably people I'm talking to, actually talking to on a daily basis anyway. So I don't know. There's that aspect, but I want to jump in real quick and go from what you just said about programming and entertainment and go to news, because you brought up earlier about how news is, you know, you can't even watch it with your son anymore. And both you and I have news backgrounds. We used to work together with Kevin Hunsberger of My 123 Cents, cheap plug. And I remember when I left the TV station that we were working, I left a book on our break room table called How News Makes You Dumb. And it was basically looking at how we live in a 24-hour news cycle, you know, with CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. But there's not enough news to fill up 24 hours a day. And even, you know, recently with the Parkland shooting, like I got frustrated because to me the coverage on news was very exploitive, where when you don't have new information, don't keep a camera on something just to show people's frantic, you know, and people being scared. And I think that's one of the problem with our news right now is it's being very divisive. And I mean we could save this for another episode because there was so much depth there, but much like entertainment programming is promoting, as we said, the negative behavior, I think news is also contributing to our divisive society.
Absolutely. You know, when CNN came along and essentially created the format that we now know as the 24-hour news network, and then other networks jumped on board, but yet we're not dedicating the resources. We're not giving journalists the time they need to flesh out these stories that they're working on. And you know, specifically when you're looking at, you know, a half hour newscast, you're looking at 30-second, 1 minute, 1.5 minute snippets of very complex stories. And you know, when you take it down to a local level, where at least our generation, I don't know right now so much the younger generation is dependent and watching local news, but we certainly are. And you know, it's still a very trusted source of information, and yet, as you and I both know from being in the business, you know, reporters are underpaid, overworked, and you know, they're asked to turn 3, 4, 5 stories a day. And when you get a very complex issue, it's just impossible. It's so hard to really unpack that and present it to all the sides of the issue to the viewers when it's just, you know, one of so many different balls that you're juggling that day. So yeah, I certainly think that there's a decline in the resources available to our journalists, and yet they're, you know, expected to fight for viewers. And what's a quick way to do that? Drum up controversy, play off those controversies, focus on the divisive issues versus you know, some maybe community oriented issues. So yeah, it is also a changing landscape in the news industry, and then our current political landscape is really dominating the coverage right now of 24-hour news networks. And you know, that's unfortunate for a few things too, because there's a lot of other things happening out there that we should be focusing on that we're not, because it's all politics all the time.
Well, it's all politics, and I think you and I look at politics a little differently. I think we're probably, and you know, Kevin and I have had this discussion on this podcast before, where I think we're separate, but we're closer than the media or society would have us think we are, especially if we have rational discussion, which brings up a quote that I've seen several times over the last month or so. And it's, you know, we were brought up, told you never discuss religion or politics, when instead what we should have been taught is how to discuss sensitive issues civilly, with civility. And I think that's a big issue in society.
Absolutely.
And, you know, to bring it back once again to the what inspired this episode of Mr. Rogers is, you know, his powerful quote when fighting for a grant to keep public television alive, saying feelings are mentionable and manageable. And that goes right along with what you're saying of, yeah, we should have been taught how to discuss these subjects that divide us. And you, I think, are spot on, Chad, when you say that we're probably, no matter where we lie on the political spectrum, we're not that far apart as we're led to believe. And again, you know, that it goes back to what we're seeing on television, how these very complex issues are just being broken down into right versus wrong, when that is not the case, and that is not how it works anymore. If it ever did, these are very complex issues, and we as a society have to find a way to communicate and talk about them in a civil way. And right now we're failing to do that. And right now it seems like every platform, it's just this back and forth divisiveness from social media to the different news networks. It's an interesting phenomenon right now of how we can't get on the same page with seemingly anything. And I can't remember a time where the country's been more divisive, you know, in my 40 plus short years.
Yeah, and I mean, this is going to be the cynical take for portion of the show is, I look at politics, and, you know, I am no political expert by any means. I really have only been semi-following politics since the 2004 election. But it seems to me, and I get what I'm about to say is a comparison, and it works because our current commander-in-chief is a WWE Hall of Famer, but politics are very much in line with professional wrestling right now, where they will go out and they will, you know, insult the other side. Each side will cut a promo saying how bad the other side is and everything. But behind the scenes, maybe I am just too much of a cynic, but I believe that they are actually like getting together and laughing at society at how well they can play each side off the other and get what they want. Because, you know, we have politicians that, you know, unfortunately are becoming politicians for life. And reaping the benefits of this dumbed down society that we just keep putting them back in power, even though you look at the approval ratings and they're at all time lows, and you're like, why do we keep? We're just in this cycle that we refuse to break.
It really is crazy. I mean, we know the system is broken. Every person that I talk to is disgusted with the current politicians in power, and yet somehow, like you say, we just keep voting the same people from the same parties in. You know, to do anything different, to vote all independent is a big, you know, it's a big step and a scary thing. But if we are going to shake things up and ever change things, which we have the power to do, but we have to be able to take that scary leap to do so. That is interesting because you're right. Approval ratings show it. If you just talk to people, you'll hear them echo the same sentiment that everybody's really unhappy with the way things are going. I do disagree with, and I'm also not being in the political landscape, thankfully. I'm not sure about what's happening behind the scenes, but there's an interesting documentary called Patriocracy. And it breaks down the divide, the growing divide between the left and the right. And one of the politicians that is interviewed in the documentary, said that Washington used to be civil in that although they might be on different sides, regardless of party, they were colleagues. And so you'd see a Republican and a Democrat going out to dinner to, and you know, their children were in the same schools together and played on the same ball teams together. And he said that doesn't exist anymore. And so I don't know if I have as much faith as you do in them working together behind the scenes. Certainly some still do and know how, but I think a lot have just dug their heels in on their party's issues, and they're not willing to budge.
Yeah, I can see that, and I would agree that just for some reason the word compromise has been lost in a politician's vocabulary, and now compromise just means give me everything that I want, otherwise I'm not going to vote for anything. As we said, you know, you talked about news being 30-second, 1-minute long discussions of issues. Political ads are the same way, which you get it, you know, during the political season, you get a 30-second spot telling you why, not why you should vote for a candidate, but why you should vote against the other candidate. And unfortunately, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think enough people are doing research. They're just taking what they see on television, and then when they get into the polling place, they're voting for the name brand recognition instead of looking to see who is a candidate that actually either aligns with their point of view or seems willing to want to make that change. Would you agree?
Yeah. So first I want to go back to the comment you made about the political ads in general. And this dates back to what's known as the Daisy ad from the 1964 presidential election. And Lyndon B. Johnson ran an ad, and it only aired once, but it had a little girl in a field picking the petals off a daisy and counting down. And then it transitioned into a bomb going off. And it was essentially attacking Barry Goldwater, calling him a warmonger, and that if you vote for Goldwater means this is what's going to happen to your beautiful children out in the fields. And this was the first like big attack ad. And what researchers discovered is that it was easier to keep people away from the polls and not just vote than it was to sway a voter to your candidate. And so that's when we saw the 60s and then eventually into the 70s, and then what we see today ramped up is the shift to from, you know, an attempt to say this is why I'm a good candidate to the my opponent's a terrible candidate, and just, you know, it starts to sour everyone on the entire political process, the process of democracy in general. And, you know, it worked. You look at voter turnout now, and it's terrible in a free society when less than half the people vote. And yet politicians are playing such an important role in how we live. So, yeah, certainly the way we approach even just the voting process and through the political advertisements, and then the way that they, again, yeah, the brand. It's now a brand, and a couple, you know, these major complex issues that we should be talking about have been boiled down to just it's a Republican issue, it's a Democratic issue, it's right or left, and that's not a way to operate in a very increasingly complex society.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like we have so many labels on things these days. Like, you know, if you want to be Democrat, you have to be X, Y, and Z. If you want to be a Republican, you have to be X, Y, and Z. Where, I don't know, maybe I'm trying to give myself too much credit, but I would rather look at each individual issue and make a choice than vote blanket statement.
Yeah, I'm always shocked at how these issues and how these politicians can just, you know, immediately, if I'm a Republican, I believe this, this, and this. And if I'm a Democrat, I believe this, this, and this. And that's just silly. And I think it goes back to what you said about, you know, if we just talked, we'd find out that, okay, you know, on some issues I'm more moderate, and on some issues I'm more conservative, and we've got a lot more in common on these issues than we might think.
Yeah, and then that's where you hopefully can come up with a solution to the problem, or at least discuss it. I mean, right now it's when you see discussions on news, it's very much either let's take immigration for an example. It's either you totally want a wall, or you just want open borders and anybody comes in. There's no differentiating between what type of immigration or what you want to allow. And I don't know, to me that just seems so short-sighted and ineffective way of communication.
Well, and then, you know, let's talk about the impact of it. You know, you turn on CNN in the middle of the day and you see Jake Tapper on there, and he's got Kellyanne Conway on there, and they end up in a shouting match. And that's, you know, we're still receiving social instruction to some degree from what we see on television. And so when we see our news anchors and our representatives for our elected officials in a shouting match, how are we then going to talk about these things when the paid professionals cannot talk about these things without yelling at each other?
Yeah, and I think, again, this may be more theatrical than actual, but you know the old news saying, if it bleeds, it leads. Well, what makes for better television? Arguments and controversy or civil debate?
Right. And that's a question that we as a society have to answer. Again, we have the power. We always have the power. We can vote with literally our votes, or we can vote with our money. We can, you know, not shop with the advertisers that, you know, have the commercials during these programs. And I will say this, and what's happened, without getting into the debate about the issue of gun rights and gun ownership, but what's happened after the Parkland, Florida shooting has been, for me personally, very inspiring to see the young generation that takes a lot of flack, let's be honest, of, you know, all they do is stay inside and stay on their phones and this and that, and they're unmotivated. It's been amazing to watch them rally together on their own around a cause, and you're starting to see with the March for Life movement, you're starting to see with the way people reacted to the companies that were supporting the NRA. There was a big movement on social media to boycott those companies, and then, you know, post about it and put the hashtag boycott NRA, that sort of thing. And, you know, it was people voting with their dollars. It was how we have power when we're dealing with mass media, with mass media conglomerates and the advertisers that it essentially, let's not forget that advertising keeps this whole train going. You take away the advertising element and you take away the income for mass media. So we do still have a voice, and we could say, I'm tired of seeing talking heads shout at each other on television. I'm going to tune in to a program with civil discourse. But we're not seeing that. We're seeing PBS on its last legs, which is a bastion for that type of debate and discussion. So we have the power, and we have to decide as a society to say, no, I'm tuning out, or I'm going to take it a step further and even voice my displeasure by, you know, boycotting you as an advertiser if you, you know, run commercials during this type of programming. So, you know, that's the power we have. And I don't know if as a society we realize that. I don't know if the everyday average American realizes the power that they actually have if they choose to use it.
Yeah, I am not a fan of sponsored boycotts where, again, to me that sounds more like just going along with the flow instead of making a personal choice. But I do agree that, yes, if you don't support a company or don't want to support them, then by all means, you have that right to not shop there, not buy their products. And, yes, use your voice. And I know it's harder to boycott certain businesses than others, depending on where you live and what you're buying. But I agree with you in regards to hopefully maybe this is the start of this next generation, this next movement. The 60s had the civil rights movement, anti-war, while the stuff that's going on right now, I don't fully support the way that it's happening. I'm with you. I give them credit for actually using their voice and speaking up. And hopefully that this will lead to this discussion that we need to have, the civil discussion, which unfortunately I'm not seeing a whole lot of right now, because it is a lot of the, F the NRA, just more negative attacking than let's come together and try to find a common solution or a solution at all, instead of I think there's a lot of hyperbole and just generic thought going on. And I think that this is why we need discussion, because you have to articulate your idea, not just throw out catchphrases.
So maybe it's my proximity to Parkland, Florida. I'm located in just about an hour north of there. Yeah, I've seen the opposite, at least out of them personally, the students and how they united. When I say I'm impressed, one of the things I'm most impressed with is the way they've handled themselves in such a civil manner, that they haven't been going after the other side, if you will, going after the NRA in a negative light. They've been very calm. They've been very collected. And from what I've seen from them, certainly not from everyone, but from that group down in Parkland, respectful. I mean, they're doing what they should. They're using facts. They're using research, and they're using their voice and saying, this is what we're asking for, and we're not alone. And then you see in the March for Life over this past weekend, they are not alone. This time period does, like you said, it's got a real 60s feel to it. I think that, as I mentioned earlier, with the election and the at least the electoral vote going in favor of Donald Trump, I think that that was a backlash to some of that the onslaught of progressive movements happening all at once, and a group of people saying we're not ready for this. I think what we're seeing now, to some degree, is the younger generation saying, yes, we are ready for it, that we're part of it, and we want to be an inclusive society. And I think it's great. And like I said, yeah, it definitely has a 60s revolution vibe to it. And I think that for the most part, they've done a great job in rallying what's been a generation that has really just, like I said, been hammered and labeled lazy and apathetic. And I love that a lot of them are saying, no, we're not. And here's what we think about all this.
Yeah. Well, next year is the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. So maybe we can have another giant music festival where people can buy $10 Pepsis and $15 food items like Woodstock 25.
Well, our generation, our generation proved that we couldn't handle. We like to throw around labels, but yet, we couldn't handle a Woodstock. Certainly, it was commercialized, but it was also embarrassing to see the way people were acting, and that's on us. That's on your and I generation. I don't know if we're ready for that yet. We'll see. Maybe they can handle it better than we could.
Maybe. And, during Woodstock 25 is when you had Jackass, I believe, was popular at the time. So yes, as to tie this all back together, what we see on television is a reflection of the society that we live in. So hopefully going forward, like you said, maybe this is a chance for the next All in the Family to come out. Maybe this is, I don't know. I just hope whatever happens that we figure out the way to again have civil discourse and sit down and talk to each other. And I think this goes back all the way back to the beginning of the show, back to Mr. Rogers, and that is know your neighbors and treat everyone like your neighbor.
A beautiful message, and I think one that is certainly lost right now. Certainly it's not in the television landscape, and I think that just as a society right now, we've lost that, absolutely. And hopefully we can come back to that.
All right. Well, Travis, thanks for joining me again. I think this was a good discussion, and you know, granted, there are a lot of things that we could go into and have like another two-hour discussion about politics and society, but this one, I think we hit the main points that we tried to set out to do, and hopefully the listener out there agrees. And if you have any comments, you know, you can always hit us up on Twitter at ChatSmart. Travis, you are on Twitter.
Yes, correct? At Pop Cult IQ.
Say that again.
At Pop Cult IQ.
PopCultIQ. Yes. Thanks, Travis, and
always a pleasure, Chad. Thanks so much.
For giving generation upon generation of children confidence in themselves, for being their friend, for telling them again and again and again that they are special and that they have worth. It is my honor on behalf of everyone here and on behalf of the millions of children whose mornings you have brightened with your kindness to present you with this Lifetime Achievement Award.
Oh, it's a beautiful night in this neighborhood. So many people have helped me to come to this night. Some of you are here, some are far away, some are even in heaven. All of us have special ones who have loved us into being. Would you just take, along with me, 10 seconds to think of the people who have helped you become who you are. Those who have cared about you and wanted what was best for you in life. 10 seconds of silence. I'll watch the time. Whomever you've been thinking about, how pleased they must be to know the difference you feel they've made. You know, they're the kind of people television does well to offer our world.